Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents City of Hope, City of Rage, Miami, 1968 to 1994, by Seth A. Weitz, narrated by Graham Rowett. Introduction. Miami. The name evokes many different memories and reactions. Miami, the magic city. South Beach, glitz and glamour, fun in the sun. Miami, drugs and crime, uprisings and income inequality. To some, Miami is a dream, not a reality. A fairyland, as highlighted by Julio Capo in his 2017 work, Welcome to Fairyland, Queer Miami Before 1940, where visitors could suspend reality and the rules of the real world. When television networks show University of Miami football games, they often broadcast images of nightlife on South Beach, which is more than 10 miles away from the inland Coral Gables campus. Meanwhile, the team plays in a stadium in Miami Gardens, which is close to 20 miles away on the border with Broward County, in a predominantly lower-income and middle-class black neighborhood. Miami lures you in, both physically and metaphorically. Its magnetism affects residents and outsiders alike. After World War II, the phrase, sand in your shoes, gained in popularity to capture the feeling that once you visited the magical beaches of Miami, you could never forget them, never truly go home. Today, the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce presents a Sand in My Shoes Award to individuals who have demonstrated exceptional public service to the Greater Miami area. Miami has a conflicted past, blossoming as one of the main playgrounds for Americans from across the country, while enforcing the same rigid segregationist policies as the rest of the state and the South. But Miami was always different. Its unique qualities were always present, but after World War II, the city saw one of its many booms, with an influx of immigrants from the North, mainly the Northeast, many of whom were Jewish and supported civil rights. This work examines a major transformative period in Miami's history, the years between 1968 and 1994, when the young city was both searching for an identity and striving for maturity. This maturity, according to Fernand Amandi, a managing partner of Ben Dixon and Amandi, the nation's leading multilingual and multi-ethnic public opinion research and strategic communications consulting firm, and a professor at the University of Miami, Miami still lacks. Amandi, who is also one of the city's leading democratic voices, bases this immaturity in the fact that, despite its founding in 1896, the real Miami is a mere 70 to 75 years old, as the city only started to come into its own after World War II. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, Miami, whose proximity to Latin America and the Caribbean meant it always had a Hispanic population, experienced a mass wave of Cuban migration due to Fidel Castro's revolution. The city is physically located closer to the Bahamas, Haiti, and Cuba than it is Tallahassee or its adjoining neighbor states, Georgia and Alabama, and for much of its existence, it has looked south toward Latin America rather than to the American South. As the country changed in the 1960s, Miami was rocked by first of several uprisings, which reflected decades of frustration within Miami's black community. 1968, the year of the first major uprising, was also a year of major discord in the United States, with the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy, and the rising discontent over the Vietnam War. A mere 300 miles from communist Cuba, Miami, as it grew into a major American city, was gripped in a fight for its identity. Miami began to grow up in the 25 years after 1968, and as it transformed into a major global metropolis, many felt left behind, and still do today. Miami remains among the most segregated cities in the country. Being relatively young, with many immigrants and transplants, it has retained an every-man-for-himself attitude. This differentiates Miami from many other American cities, especially those that can trace their origins back further and whose inhabitants have called their locales home for generations. The fact that most Cuban refugees initially planned to return to Cuba once Castro was overthrown only underscores this point and prompts the larger question of whether there is a sense of ownership in the city. Do people want to make the city better? That would require putting down roots, which many are not willing to do. Snowbirds and developers move in and displace more entrenched Miamians with frequency. One could argue there is not much of a communal vibe in Miami, and that the various neighborhoods serve as disparate parts only loosely linked together. Robin Farzad, author of Hotel Scarface, where cocaine cowboys partied and plotted to control Miami, and host of Full Disclosure on NPR, told me in an interview that he likens the city to Lagos, Nigeria in this regard. The only sense of we, at times, are the Miami Hurricanes, the Miami Dolphins, or the Miami Heat. But even then, there are so many transplants that a game against the New York Jets or New York Knicks could see a stadium or arena packed with thousands of former New Yorkers rooting passionately against the home team. While this work focuses on three decades of profound change in the so-called Magic City, it concentrates on the pressing question of how Miami is defined and by whom. For Fernand Amandi, a Miami native who has studied every aspect of the city, the words that best capture its essence are freedom, sun, heat, passion, corruption, the boiling tensions of different ethnic communities, immaturity, disappointment, exotic, sensual, and superficial. Miami is, and always has been, many things, one of those being that it is difficult to define. From the 1960s to the 1990s, Miami transformed from a U.S. southern city to a global metropolis, from a predominantly white city to a predominantly Hispanic city. While Miami was always a destination for tourists, the tourists who showed up changed. Once a playground for New York and Jewish pleasure seekers, by the 1980s, most tourists hailed from Latin America. In the 1950s, many Miamians felt safe leaving their front doors unlocked, but by the 1970s and 1980s, headlines across the country described the city as a war zone. The new Miami was captured in art, music, and especially on television shows and movies such as Miami Vice and Scarface, which painted images of an out-of-control, corrupt, and crime-ridden city, overrun with violence and immigrants, money, drugs, beautiful women, and flashy cars. This was Miami, but there was also another Miami that only Miamians knew, including the mundane suburbs, which every major city had in the 1980s. But Miami was unique in that in its sedate suburbs you could find bodies stuffed in garbage bags, as happened in 1985 when the partial remains of a man and a woman, dubbed by police as Tommy and Teresa Torso, were discovered in the usually quiet suburban neighborhood of Pinecrest, today the village of Pinecrest, located on the South Dixie Highway. Miami's troubles and changes certainly did not begin in 1968, as the city's checkered past preceded that year, but its transformation over the following three decades, marked by racially motivated uprisings, mass immigration, crime, and cultural shifts, helped define modern Miami more than any other period in the city's 125-year history. Miami has been a contradiction, an enigma, since its founding in 1896, and residents and outsiders have been trying to solve the puzzle and define the city ever since. It is a city that has desperately tried to create an image for nearly a century and has spent the last 40 years trying to erase one that some Miamians, such as former Mayor Xavier Suarez, 1985 to 1993, 1997 to 1998, feel is exaggerated. Suarez speaks often of the national media's penchant for characterizing the city in a negative light and making gross generalizations, which he refers to as crapola. While Miami has had a troubled history and still suffers from segregation, corruption, police brutality, and other major problems, Suarez does not feel the city gets the credit it deserves as an international metropolis and a melting pot, where people of different races, religions, and ethnicities coexist and have for decades. Miami is, and will be for the foreseeable future, a city trying to define itself and its legacy within Florida and the nation. Image is important to any city, but arguably nowhere is this more important than in Miami, where tourism is the city's leading industry. This public facing makes it extremely important that city officials and others present the city in a positive light, even when faced with uprisings or natural disasters. Miami has faced challenges throughout its existence, some man-made, some acts of nature. After the devastating 1926 hurricane known as the Great Miami Storm, some outsiders felt the city would not bounce back. But the natural disaster ended up giving the University of Miami athletic teams their names. A local journalist credited the Miami Spirit with saving the city from the storm, which caused an adjusted $300 billion worth of damage and killed at least 17 people. The term Spirit of Miami has been used over the last century to describe a myriad of entities and events, from a dinner cruise and a plane to an ill-fated football franchise in the now-defunct United States Football League. Developer Woody Weiser, who is responsible for the development of the Adrian Arsht Center for the Performing Arts, which is part of downtown Miami's ongoing revitalization, purchased the Washington Federals franchise with the aim of moving them to Miami's Orange Bowl in 1985. University of Miami head coach Howard Schnellenberger, whose team had won a national championship in 1983 and helped to quell racial tensions after what is referred to as the 1982 riots, would serve as head coach, general manager, and part owner. The franchise, however, never got off the ground because of competition from the Miami Dolphins and the Miami Hurricanes. The Port of Miami, referred to by Forbes as the cruise capital of the world, is the busiest cruise port in the world. In 2019, Miami reported grossing $151 billion, primarily from the tourism, trade, media, and finance sectors. Miami has relied on tourism and tourist dollars for close to 100 years, which has led to various images of the city. The one plastered on brochures, the one flashed over the nightly news, and the one known to the city's residents. Miami has long been a city of immigrants, whether from the northern United States, Latin America, or elsewhere, and these immigrants have shaped Miami's politics, culture, and society. They've also done their part in defining the city, but that definition is often unique to each group. What may be true for Cuban Americans may not be true for Jewish Miamians or Black Miamians. We must also consider the fact that the Jewish population in Miami is not homogeneous, as there is a large, if shrinking, Reform Jewish population, and also a large Orthodox and Hasidic population, mostly on Miami Beach. The same can be said of the Hispanic population. Mention Miami and Cuban Americans come to mind, but according to 2010 census data, while more than 70% of this city's population was classified as Hispanic, only 34.4% were of Cuban origin. Another 16% came from Central America and 9% from South America. Nicaraguans have a very different experience in Miami than Cubans do, and, as will be explored, Colombians, especially in the 1980s, had a different experience from everyone. Even the city's Black population is not homogeneous, as close to 6% are first or second generation immigrants from the Caribbean, with most coming from Haiti, Jamaica, and the Bahamas. There is also a sizable Afro-Cuban and Afro-Latino population. A deeper dive into the numbers related to employment figures, home ownership, and median income shows that in 2020, Miami's racial and ethnic populations were still living very different lives. The median household income in Miami-Dade County in 2020 was $53,537, but it was $56,791 for white non-Hispanics and $50,730 for Hispanic and Latino. Black and African American stood at the lowest in the county, as has been the case for almost the entirety of these statistics, at $40,162, more than $13,000 below the overall median income and $3,000 below the state's Black and African American number. This also placed Black Miamians below the income secured by American Indians. There is a growing discussion surrounding usage of the word riot to discuss the uprisings in Black communities in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, and beyond. These dialogues are taking place within Black communities in cities from Newark to Detroit, as well as within academic and scholarly circles, and needs to be addressed here, given the numerous uprisings within the Black community that Miami experienced between the 1960s and the 1990s. Historically, the term riot has been used, and is still used by some, but over the past decade the terminology has shifted in favor of rebellion or uprising. On the 50th anniversary of what was historically referred to as the 1967 Detroit Riot, Bill McGraw penned an article in the Detroit Free Press in which he explored not only the events, but also how they are remembered, and focused heavily on the use of the word riot. He began his discussion by defining both riot and rebellion, and noting that critics of the word riot maintain that it is too superficial, and that it describes the violence, but sells short the built-up anger and long-simmering resentment over police brutality. This holds true in Detroit and Miami and across the country. In Detroit, the word riot has disappeared from many official city texts, and the word chosen to replace it is rebellion. The same can be said for Newark, where a city official noted, "Newark uses the term rebellion. Riot suggests that people were beating each other up in some giant street fight when it was the residents fighting against the government." William Winkle, a curatorial assistant at the Detroit Historical Museum, said that riot was used by those who tended to be more suburban and politically conservative, while Black residents and liberal whites tended to use rebellion. Echoing this sentiment 2 years earlier, sociologist Max Herman proclaimed at a UCLA Zocalo public square event, "We've been using the words riot and rebellion interchangeably, but it's really indicative of where you're coming from, which word you choose. Rioting implies there's no motive involved. Rebellion implies a reaction to injustice." While this discussion continues nationwide, no such overarching discussion has taken place in Miami. Some are beginning to refer to the historical events in different terms, but scholar Marvin Dunn does not. Dunn, who was called in the aftermath of what has historically been referred to as the McDuffie riots to testify before a congressional committee, maintained that when the matter was referred to as an uprising, he took exception. He further explained, "Rebellions have articulable goals and leaders. Riots don't." In April 2021, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law a highly controversial piece of legislation, House Bill 1, known as the Anti-Riot Law. Portions of the law were blocked by U.S. District Judge Mark Walker in Tallahassee, and in his 90-page decision, he highlighted the definition of riot. He also maintained, "If this court does not enjoin the statute's enforcement, the lawless actions of a few rogue individuals could effectively criminalize the protected speech of hundreds, if not thousands, of law-abiding Floridians." He also warned that it could return Florida to Jim Crow-era segregationist practices. Miami is a fascinating subject, and numerous books have been written about various aspects of the city, all of which are invaluable to the subject matter or time period they cover. Some are broad in scope, such as Marvin Dunn's Black Miami in the 20th Century, which, as the title suggests, looks at the complete history of black people in Miami over the course of the city's history. Dunn also compiled a report on what was called the 1980 Miami or McDuffie riots with Bruce Porter, The Miami Riots, Crossing the Bounds, the foremost examination of the uprising, as well as producing A History of Florida, Through Black Eyes, a look at black Floridians from the Spanish period to the present. N.D.B. Connolly's A World Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida examines the means through which black Miamians and South Floridians were segregated by an actual color line, implemented through real estate and government ordinances, while Chanel N. Rose looks at the history of Miami through the lens of the black freedom struggle in her 2015 work, The Struggle for Black Freedom in Miami, Civil Rights and America's Tourist Paradise, 1896 to 1968. The late Raymond Moll, the leading scholar on Jewish Florida, specifically Jewish Miami, published numerous articles on the topic, and the award-winning South of the South, Jewish Activists in the Civil Rights Movement in Miami, 1945 to 1960. His book is contrasted by Jews of South Florida, an edited volume that takes a broad look at the Jewish history of South Florida. Gerald Posner studies the intersection of crime and drugs in the 1980s in his Miami Babylon, Crime, Wealth, and Power, A Dispatch from the Beach, while author Joan Didion moved to Miami in the mid-1980s to study the then infamous city, commenting on crime, drugs, and the city's Cuban and Colombian populations in Miami. Mayor Xavier Suarez was especially critical of Didion's book for what he felt was its harsh portrayal of Miami's Cuban-American population. Other works that study Cuban-Americans and the Colombian drug wars of the 1980s include The Mariel Boatlift, A Cuban-American Journey, by Victor Andres Triay, and Kings of Cocaine, by Guy Gugliotta and Jeff Lean. The summer of 2020 saw the release of journalist Nicholas Griffin's The Year of Dangerous Days, Riots, Refugees, and Cocaine in Miami, 1980, which, as the title suggests, examines the tumultuous year of 1980 in Miami, while Julio Capo's 2017 book, Welcome to Fairyland, Queer Miami Before 1940, looks at the city's LGBTQ population in the pre-World War II era. This book fits well within the current historiography and contributes to knowledge of the subject by examining, for example, the understudied years between 1980 and the mid-1990s. Those years do not stand alone in a vacuum, and they are easily linked to Miami's chaotic and often tumultuous but fascinating past. As a native Miamian who grew up in the 1980s and 1990s, I lived part of this story. And while I have not lived in the area since I moved away to go to college, it will always hold a place in my heart, and it has always been a goal of mine to examine its history and tell a piece of its story. I aim to give a voice to the city in this work and to highlight, as much as possible, the real Miami. Miami has existed as a city for a little more than a century, and during that time it has grown immensely, from a trading post on the Miami River to an international tourist destination, with a metropolitan area population of 6,158,824, making it the seventh largest metropolis in the United States, with a downtown boasting the nation's third tallest skyline. Miami grew from a city struggling to exist at all in the early 20th century to a sprawling winter playground for northern tourists by the 1920s and 1930s. Throughout the early part of the century, Miami tried to define itself according to Northerners' vision of the city as an oasis and a winter escape, While native Floridians and white Miamians saw Miami as an extension of Florida and the Deep South. The city's growing black population was trying to fit in and find its role. Miami had a small Jewish population before World War II, as well as a small Hispanic population, but for most of the first half of the 20th century, Miami was a black and white city. As New York University professor Stephen Pedigo describes Miami, it has always been a tale of two cities. It has attracted the richest people in the world, and more of them are coming. But it also has an economy based on tourism and hospitality and service, which is generating some of the lowest wages in the United States. So it's by definition one of the most unequal economies in the nation. This was the case in the 1920s, and it is still true today. The 1940s and 1950s saw even more growth, as Miami became home to one of the nation's largest Jewish populations, and the city once again tried to carve out a place for itself within the state and the nation. This period also saw a strengthening of Jim Crow, which would carry into the 1960s. Dr. John O. Brown, a native of Oklahoma who moved to Miami in 1955 and was a charter member of the city's chapter of the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, a member of Miami's NAACP, and participated in numerous sit-ins and wade-ins across the city in the 1950s and early 1960s, described Miami in shocking terms, describing it as one of the most segregated cities in the United States. I mean, we talk about Birmingham and Memphis and Atlanta. Segregation was just as rampant here, or probably worse. And probably the economy of Miami, as far as blacks was concerned, is probably the lowest in the nation of any urban area. When asked if he thought Miami was a battleground for the national integration and civil rights fight, he simply stated, "Oh, it definitely is. And the thing about Miami that makes it different from any of the other major cities of this country, I mean, we're not the only one that has a bunch of Latins, and with the blacks and with the Jews and the others, there are many cities. San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York. But the thing that's quaint about Miami is the fact of job opportunities. I mean, it's not an industrial city, so there's only one little pie out here, and that pie has to be split in so many different directions." The civil rights battle would also usher in a new chapter in Miami's history as Cubans, who had been present in Florida, particularly Key West and Tampa, since the 1800s, began to reshape Miami's demographics, culture, and political landscape after Fidel Castro's 1959 revolution and subsequent regime change. Racial tensions would once again take center stage in the 1970s as Miami's black population, which had felt left behind for decades, began to make itself heard, starting with the uprising in 1968 that carried into the 1970s. Miami's LGBTQ population, which had always been more prevalent here than in other southern cities during the first half of the 20th century, began to push for more rights at a time when Florida still had archaic, discriminatory laws that criminalized homosexuality as a crime against nature. The latter part of 1970s saw one of the major battles for LGBTQ rights in the nation, as Anita Bryant led a self-proclaimed moral crusade against the movement in 1977 in Dade County. Perhaps no decade defined Miami more in the eyes of the nation and the world than the 1980s. The decade was dominated by drugs, racial unrest, a building frenzy that transformed the skyline, and massive immigration influxes from Latin America, especially from Cuba and Haiti. Sports also took center stage in the community in this period, from the successes of the Miami Dolphins and Miami Hurricanes on the gridiron to the establishment and popularity of the National Basketball Association's Miami Heat, who began play in the predominantly black impoverished Overtown in 1988. To outsiders, Miami was a superficial, plastic, glitzy, drug and crime-infested city where tourists were murdered if they took a wrong turn and ventured off Interstate 95 while driving to their luxurious hotels on Miami Beach. A closer examination shows much more to the city during this decade, as was the case in all previous.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?